Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is not happy about recording at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I'm Kevin Day. He is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. 9 a.m, Kieran. It's my fault, I know, because I'm working. But 9 a.m. on a Sunday, according to the adverts, Kieran, the rest of the world are having breakfast in bed on a memory foam mattress accompanied by two perfect kids and a Labrador puppy. Where did we go wrong? Where did we go wrong, Kieran, on the podcast described this week as the shipping forecast of football? We had a lovely message from a chap who was trying to describe to a friend what the pod was, and his wife interjected and said, "It's the shipping forecast of football." I told Ali that, expecting a bit of sympathy, and she went, "Well, it's about right." Yeah. The shipping forecast is an essential bit of kit, Kieran, isn't it? Everybody needs a shipping forecast.
I'm proud of that. I'm made up.
Yes, oh, yeah. I like the idea that chief executives of football clubs are tuning in at 3 o'clock in the morning just to see what way the wind is blowing in the football world. It's questions day, Kieran. My first question is, how long will it be before Palace are finally above Brighton? Apparently, your manager is still one of the best in the country, despite the lack of victories to prove it.
Yes, I had the joys of going to Aston Villa yesterday, cool. And I got back at 1:30 a.m.
Wow!
Because really? It turns out that we weren't the only football club heading that way, and therefore on the routes back, it appeared to be a dickhead's day out competition run by a series of fans of various clubs who decided to take their differences with each other out on the train. And therefore the trains decided, well, we're not happy about this, and we're just gonna stay put until the old bill turn up. And it was what a disastrous day. It was shocking football. Cost a fortune because train prices are ridiculous, and we lost. So yeah, apart from that, it was great.
Yeah, but I take solace, Kieran, in the fact that I think most of those fans won't be listening to this pod. I can't imagine the hooligan accountant Venn diagram crosses over. I don't know. There might be a couple. Our first question today, Kieran, it's questions day, and our first question comes from Jack Diath. And Jack says, I have a question regarding a TV advert. That's probably subconsciously what put in my mind to ad-lib that introduction. I have a question regarding a TV advert for Deliveroo during the Euros, which I can only describe as Tyrone Mings, Jack Grealish and co. doing keepy-uppies in front of a katsu curry, which was probably the pitch that the advertising company did. You see, it's basically Tyrone Mings doing keepy-uppies in front of a katsu curry. We'll have it, says Deliveroo. As England has a sponsorship deal with Deliveroo on their training gear, is this advert likely to be part of that deal, or are they paying extra to feature England players? Likewise, I guess the players are getting paid for this, but is the FA getting extra for letting their players and kits appear? Also, some of the more high-profile England players don't seem to be in the ad, so I'm guessing the players had some kind of right to refuse.
I don't think it's necessarily a right to refuse, but what the Football Association will say to commercial partners is that we can offer you, let's say, three tiers of advertising product. And tier number one, we can get you Harry Kane, Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, some of the really high-profile players. Then we'll drop down. And this is no disrespect to the likes of Tyrone Mings, given especially that he scored a goal against us yesterday, who won't be as familiar to perhaps non-football fans, and therefore people go, well, you know, who's he? Whereas Harry Kane, England captain and so on. So they will offer them tiered products. I think it's unreasonable to expect all, you know, 23 members of the England squad to turn up to every single advert. So it's a case of just trying to allocate your resources. And the players will have that as part of their contract with the FA. I mean, the players are absolutely brilliant in the sense that their match fees for many, many years now, they've donated to charity, but they are paid for other aspects of their relationship with England. And clearly they are entitled to a share of the proceeds. What you will also see, and this is where the England kit comes in and the England badge, is that you will see individual players during either the World Cup period or the Euros period, they will be advertising products themselves. But when you see Lionel Messi doing this, and when you see Cristiano Ronaldo, and he's been doing one recently that appears all the time on Sky, it's that they're wearing neutral shirts because the clubs will say, if you want Cristiano Ronaldo in a Manchester United shirt, we want a share of that as well. Cristiano's representatives will say, well, actually, we'd rather all the money go to him, so he'll just wear a generic white Nike football shirt or something like that.
So I'm guessing if you've got tier one, tier two, tier three, Harry Maguire is going to be around about tier six, tier seven, I would guess, because the advertisers will be going, we don't need a bloke who doesn't smile. He could do the keepy uppies in front of the cats who carry, but he needs to look cheerful. The only time he smiles is when he's scoring goals against Albania.
Then he runs off to tell the fans how great he is by cupping his ears. And I thought that is potentially going to come back to bite you in the bum. Didn't realise it was going to be as quick as it did, though.
Yeah, I'm very happy to bite Harry Maguire in the bum. Normally, I'm very that sounded wrong, didn't it? You understand what I'm saying? I wouldn't be at all happy to actually bite anybody in the bum, Kieran, but metaphorically, let's move on. It's 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Yes.
I doubt if the BAFTA people are even up this early to listen to this, which makes no sense because it's going out on Monday morning. Chris Solman says, hello, Chris. Chris Solman says, I was wondering what financial rules, if any, govern the amount to which fans can inject cash into their club. Now, as a trustee of the foundation at Crystal Palace, I found this question very interesting because he said, I recently heard that Dundee United Supporters Foundation, where fans can subscribe for £15 per month and get a vote on how money is spent. In May, the foundation accepted the club's request for £100,000 to support it after the financial effects of the pandemic, the second time they've donated this amount of money in the last year. Theoretically, could this money be used to increase the transfer budget or pay wages? And would the rules in England allow it? Now, I think it's an interesting question, Karen, but also if the Dundee United Supporters Foundation are able to stump up £200,000 in a year, then they are doing a sterling job fundraising, because I know from experience that that is a lot of money for a foundation to have in the bank.
Yes, I mean, that's an absolutely superb effort. You know, £15 a month, £180 a year, you know, on top of your season ticket. So you've got to give a huge amount of credit to the people involved in the foundation and also to the individual fans involved. As far as the use of money, there are many instances of clubs, and you've done yours at Palace, and we'd one at Brighton, which was, you know, I think it was, you know, we were trying to raise money when we were at the arse end of League Two, and we had various whip rounds, and that money was kept in a separate bank account by the supporters association, and then the club said, can we use it? And we said, well, we want it specifically to sign the player, and they signed a player called Rod Thomas, who was fantastic for half a dozen matches and then had a spectacular red card and all went slightly wrong. So as far as this money is concerned, the club fans are they're perfectly entitled to generate that money. Yes, they can gift it to the club. They can gift it to the club with conditions as well. So, you know, we would say we don't want it to go to directors' pay. We don't want it to go in dividends. We want to see this ring fenced for capital projects. and the transfer budget and wages can be part of that.
And did the club ever pay that money back to the foundation, do you know, at Brighton?
No. I mean, that money, you know, it was there to sign the player and pay his wages, and he sort of drifted off on a free contract, from what I recall. So there was no money to come back. And I know certainly from talking to other people at other clubs, you, to a certain extent, you give it in good faith, or quite often that the club will come to the supporters trust with the equivalent of a begging bowl to say, look, the directors have got no money. We've got wages to pay in a fortnight. We're screwed. Can you do anything? And then sort of, you know, to a certain extent, there's an element of emotional blackmail, because if the fans saying, well, yeah, we've got 30 grand in the bank account, the club potentially could go bust if we don't do this, and you end up handing the money over.
Yes, it's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Because I imagine the foundation, I don't know, it's a supporters foundation, which is slightly different to club foundations, but I imagine it wasn't set up with the aim of giving money to the club, rather to help the local community. So I'm not sure whether people would donate money thinking if they thought it was just going to go to the club when the club was in trouble.
Yes, I mean, and I think presumably there would have had to have been some, again, you know from your own experience, there would have had to have been a board meeting. Is this, first of all, is this within our constitution to give this money to the club? In terms of what we've seen over the course of the last couple of years, we've been in the middle of a global health issue. Football clubs have not been able to generate revenue themselves. Therefore, you know, what the Supporters Foundation may have said is that we are in extreme times, and therefore we're willing to donate money on that basis.
Excuse me. By the way, for those people who are wondering about their spread bets on whether I could get to four shows in a row without a hangover, the answer is no. It's the funeral later this week, and the Irish family started turning up last night in dribs and drabs. I don't know why they couldn't all come at once and have done with it, but they've decided to do it in rotas of three at a time. I say three. They've drunk enough of 33, but there you are. Apparently that's what he would have wanted. Who knew? Who knew? A question from Jeff Sullivan. Was it ever revealed how much money Real Madrid paid Everton for Carlo Ancelotti? I haven't seen it anywhere, but I don't know where to look. Well, Jeff, welcome to my world. Every time I do, I think I'll do some research this week. Where do I look? I don't know. I could Google things, but nothing seems to come up. How does Kieran know this stuff? So, yeah, where would he look for a start off, and what's the answer to the question?
Well, the place to look will be Everton's accounts when they are published, because normally there will be what's referred to as an exceptional item, which will – and it will be worded in management speak, so it will be something like, you know, compensation for transfer of senior staff. And therefore, that figure is likely to be given there. It is certainly, when Everton sacked Marco Silva, for example, in the accounts, the cost of sacking him was £6.5 million, which was quite good for somebody who hadn't been there very long. I have ferreted around. I've gone to some of the Spanish websites. And used Google Translate, which isn't as good as I was hoping it was going to be. It was, to a certain extent, yeah, my hovercraft is full of eels types of comments. But there appears to be a body of thought who take the view that there was a clause in his contract which allowed him to go to, I don't know if it was either just Real Madrid or a Spanish club or whatever, for £5 million. Now, it also appears that Everton weren't over-impressed with the degree of progress that the club had made under Carlo Ancelotti. You know, they finished 12th last season. And given that he was on £11 million a year, at Goodison, they probably took the view that if we can move him on, that could actually save us a lot of money because he had some more years remaining in his contract. And we'll get some compensation as well. So it actually worked out for all parties.
There's a couple of takeaways, as they say, in my industry from that answer, Kieran. A couple of takeaways here. First of all, I'm very sorry to hear about your hovercraft and the eel problem.
Yes.
Carlo Ancelotti was getting £11 million a year.
Yeah.
£11 million. And it cost Everton £6.5 million to get rid of Marco Silva.
Yeah.
That's why this pod, isn't it? I'm astonished by those amounts of money. Okay, I mean, Marco Silva wasn't a particularly a manager with a huge reputation when they got him in the first place. It wasn't an appointment that Everton fans were taking to the streets to celebrate, and they had to pay £6.5 million to get rid of him.
Yes.
It's astonishing.
We're in the wrong business.
We certainly are in the wrong business. Well, we're in the right business, Kieran, but we've got the wrong producer. That's the problem. If only the bloke who's in charge of Everton was producing this pod, we might be better off. But I find that astonishing that Everton are throwing that sort of
Everton are throwing money around like crazy. Yeah, that's why they can't sign any players anymore, because in the first 4 or 5 years under Farhad Moshiri, they spent over £500 million on players, and people were going, that can't be true. And I've got the spreadsheet and I've got the accounts, and even I went back and checked my numbers. Wow. Astounding. You know, they've got some of that money back, of course, but under the new ownership regime, they have been very generous in many ways.
But, well, the irony of that is they then go and spend nothing on Andros Townsend,
yes,
which Everton fans complained about, and so far he's been one of their best players of the season.
Yeah.
Fraser Adamson. Good morning, Fraser. He may not be listening to this in the morning. Time is a meaningless concept, Kieran. It's like a Terry Pratchett novel, this pod sometimes. Time is just all over the place. Fraser Adamson's question. In the summer, a German investment group took control of Dunfermline Athletic, as we discussed at the time.
Yeah.
Dunfermline are in the Scottish Championship, and this surely cannot be a money-making investment. Can you shed some light on why this would appeal to them? We sort of discussed this a little bit when it was happening as a rumour, but it's a very fair question, because if they are an investment group, it doesn't seem like they were going to make a lot of money out of Dunfermline, does it, with all due respect?
Yes, and I mean, Dunfermline were originally a community-owned club. This company, DAFC Football, came in and they bought 30% of Dunfermline with an option to buy a further 40%. I think they've exercised that option. Trying to work out where the potential is difficult. In 2019, which is the last year in which Dunfermline were operating in a non-COVID environment, they lost £700,000 in the year. They get decent crowds. You know, they get 4,000. Which is certainly decent by Championship standards. So where is the potential? It could be from one of three areas. First of all, they get promotion to the Premiership, and they get the benefit of you-know-who coming to town 3 or 4 times a year. So the big Edinburgh clubs, they get the big Glasgow clubs, and that has a very positive impact, on match day income, and B, on hospitality around the ground. All that doesn't affect DAF. So it could be that they feel that they can accelerate the club to the Premiership and make a bit of money there. And if we take a look at those, no disrespect to them, those other clubs in the Scottish Premiership, I've always been impressed by the fact that they effectively say, we cannot compete in terms of wages and transfer fees with Rangers and Celtic, so we won't. And we'll have a break-even model or aim for a modest profit. So that could be one of the approaches taken by DAFC Football. There is a view, and we have seen quite a few clubs in Scotland behind a management consultancy investigation into increasing the revenues within the game. Scottish football generates £2 million a year from its international TV rights. And I think there's a lot of people say, well, that's... That's not very good. Yeah, my view is, on the face of it, perhaps it doesn't seem very good, but if I was a German TV executive or a Indonesian TV executive, would I be willing to pay for rights to Scottish football? So, you know, I look at the Spanish highlights on the BBC website and a couple of others. Would I be prepared to pay a subscription for them? No. You know, who is prepared? So, yeah, I'm not actually sure that there is a market there. So that would be, and then the third issue, and this is always a fear, and there is no evidence. I've got no, you know, football clubs are property assets, so I would hope that there would be some form of golden share still held by the Dunfermline sort of supporters trust or whatever it is, which gave them some power of veto in terms of, are there going to be any property related assets? But yeah, other than that, I'm with the writer of the question, Fraser, that it does seem intuitively a very strange investment, but we are seeing a lot of money coming into Scotland from overseas, certainly a lot from the US and Germany as well. But trying to fathom out why people want to buy football clubs is always a tricky one.
You had a brief 3-second glimpse here, Kieran, of what it's like inside my mind when you desperately reach for a phrase like the writer of the question, because you can't remember who's asked it, even though it's written in block capitals on a screen in front of you.
on my mind map. Yes,
on your mind map, which is mainly in your mind. And as you've said before, mainly off air, let's not delve too much further into what else is in there. Yes, Dunfermline fans, if you want to get in touch with us about whether there is some kind of golden share, that would be interesting, because it's a very attractive part of the world, and you can imagine that the ground would make some money if they were to try and sell it for housing or whatever. And also, the writer of the next question, Kieran, could get in touch, because I've been speculating as to what his nickname would have been at school. it's Matt Plant. Now, obviously, if he was a footballer, we know what his nickname would be. It'd be Planty. But Matt, get in touch and let us know what your nickname was at school. And this is a question, Kieran. I know you've been waiting for this question.
Oh, yes.
It's a proper accountant's question.
This is Christmas a month early.
It is, isn't it, for you? Happy Christmas, Kieran. You deserve it. This is from all of us. Matt Plant's question is, ignoring growth on the capital investment, which club owners take the most financially from their club, either by dividends, director emoluments, or commercial contracts with associated companies?
Right. Well, I will give a potted answer to Mr. Plant. We'll talk about come on, if that doesn't win a BAFTA.
I just imagine the BAFTA bloke going back to his mates and going, oh, it's supposed to be about football, but there's a hovercraft, which apparently has got eels in it, and there's some half-assed puns about one of the names of the bloke in the question. And then they both forgot the name of somebody else.
We are so professional.
And then they giggled about how shit they were.
Right, I will answer Matt's answer. Matt's question in order, in the sense, in terms of dividends, this is there is no competition in this one. Step forward, the Glazer family. The Manchester United has paid a total of £388 million in dividends to owners over the years. And they are due to pay another £9 million, keep people ticking over early in January. So Manchester United are way ahead. In terms of interest to owners, so there's quite a few owners out there who have lent money to clubs on an interest-free basis. But from what I can make out, I think West Ham here, their owners, they've generated around about £20 million in interest. And in terms of the directors' salaries,
And I've had to go back all the way to when he was first appointed in 2001, which meant getting up quite early for this one. Step forward, Daniel Levy at Spurs, who has earned £38 million as a director of that particular club, including, you know, various bonuses for the new stadium and so on.
Emoluments, Kieran, is a lovely Dickensian word. How would you define it, though, for the likes of me? I mean, I kind of know what it means because I'm clever, but does it have a specific financial accounting definition?
Well, emoluments are all of the rewards that are given to an individual. So it's effectively going to be your salary, your bonuses, and benefits in kind. So, you know, do you get a company car? Are you in a health scheme? You get free access to a gym and so on. So it's salary plus benefits.
Hmm. The Glazers don't look like they've been inside a gym anytime recently, but says Mr. Pot about Mr. Kettle. Now, we always love a question. Kieran always loves a question about specific clubs. Is that Finlay?
It's Finlay. He's not had a walk as well. I've got up early. Oh. He's not had a walk, and now he's come a whimpering.
That's the most heartbreaking sound effect I've heard in my life. God, love him. Is he doing big brown eyes as well?
Oh yeah. He's got his chin resting on my knee, wagging the tail, and the eyes have gone the full. Yes,
Finlay. That's you know, I'm interpreting that whimpering. Can I meet Uncle Kevin soon? I love Uncle Kevin. Yes, so we always love, Kieran always loves a question about a specific club, and this one comes from Cam Reeves about his team, and that's Burton Albion. And Cam is curious as to how they are performing financially in the past year or so. Our owner, Ben Robinson, has always tended to run the club very well. However, surely the past year has been tough, of course, particularly with sacking a manager and having a full squad overhaul under Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank in January. What would getting relegated to League Two have done to the club, particularly because we don't have a huge fan base? It's an interesting question, but I mean, I think I've mentioned this before. Burton are one of those teams that Palace fans are desperate to get in the FA Cup because we've never played them. It's also further north than everybody thinks, but it's not a club that we mention often because it seems to be a club that sort of chugs along, small club as Cam says, but seems to get along quite well. It still seems a bit odd seeing them in the actual Football League, but how are they doing?
As a poster boy for sustainability, I think they're absolutely fantastic. They aim to break even. They were in the Championship a few years ago.
Yeah, they were.
And when they were there, they took the view of we're not going to try to live beyond our means. Their transfer spending was modest. They were paying in the Championship an average of £3,500 a week, when the average in the division as a whole was 14, and there are clubs, you know, paying players far, far more than that. So ultimately, if you think about it, there's only a limited number of jobs in football. So what? And there's far more people that want to be in football than there are jobs available. So why can't clubs just turn around and say no to unreasonable wage demands? Because if everybody did that, then you'd have sustainability in terms of the club's means of not racking up huge losses. But it's because somebody always breaks. You know, somebody always takes an easy option of saying, "Well, he's quite tasty. I'll give him an extra £10,000 a week," and then everybody follows that. But Burton have not gone down that particular route. So I think they have been very, very good, and you know, hats off to Ben Robinson for the approach that he's undertaken, and the fans buy into that as well.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you have good communication between fans and owners, or fans and the board, and here, you know, Andy Holt is absolutely brilliant. He says to the fans, "This is how much I'm willing to subsidise the club this year. I'm not going to put a penny more in. I'm going to still try to do my level best to ensure that Accrington stay in League One, ideally have a decent season. You know, at times then they're knocking around the places for the playoffs and so on, and come along and enjoy yourself. And the people of Accrington and the fan base rightly tip their hats to Andy, who is one of my heroes, and they buy into that, whereas at other clubs, and I think this is particularly an issue in the Premier League, the solution to everything is spending money that you don't have. And that's also part of the reason why the Championship's in such a pickle at present. There will be things that will come out. The fan-led review, that's due for publication later this week. And it'll be interesting to see what's in there. But just saying no is actually quite cathartic and is a way to run a sustainable football club.
So if Burton's finances are practical, realistic, what would getting relegated to League Two have done to the club? Would it not have that much of an impact then, because they run the club sustainably anyway?
Well, what will happen is that they will reduce their wage bill further. I mean, in terms of the impact of relegation, the broadcast income is likely to fall by around about £400,000. So, that's a significant amount of their revenue. And also match day revenue will fall as well, because in League One, League One's now full of, Sunderland, teams, Pompey, Ipswich, Charlton. Yeah. There's plenty of clubs with big fan bases there. And that's not the case in League Two. So they would have to take a hit as far as their wages are concerned. But looking at the club, it does appear to be it has players on relatively short-term contracts. Potentially there will be relegation clauses embedded in them, and everybody knows the score when they sign for the club. So I think it will be a hit in terms of revenue. It won't necessarily put the club into financial distress, because Ben Robinson's not that type of guy. He will have modelled upsides and downsides into the wage structure.
Having said that, though, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank can't have come cheap, can he?
I think he will be on less money than people think, because remember, really? he was at Burton. He went to QPR and that didn't work out, and then he came back to Burton. So there are some managers that are on far less money than people realize. I'm aware of a manager of Leeds United, and there'd been a lot of them over the course of the last decade, who was on £250,000 a year. Yeah, and we're talking Leeds United.
Wow. But he needs to get himself to Everton if he wants some proper money. And in the spirit of asking people to reach out to us, as we have been doing this morning, perhaps Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank would like to get in touch and tell us how much he gets paid. you never know. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. What if you had access to tomorrow's tools today? In Notion, you do. It's the AI-powered workspace where any team can turn ideas into action.
My career is sort of a bit like being a butterfly, and I'm always jumping from project to project. So therefore, Notion helps me, from summarising meetings notes and automatically generating action items, to getting answers to any question in seconds. If you can think it, you can make it. And Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a freelance football finance lecturer.
You can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, This is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Sam Rowland. Hello, Sam. Sam Rowland asks us this. Could you tell me why cases of players being too expensive to move to certain clubs seem to be becoming more common? Some cases I can think of, including Bale and Ozil, whose high wages have anchored them at clubs years beyond what anyone wants them for. Also think of players like Mbappe, who the PSG president said will never be sold or let go for free. How have football transfers become so difficult? Or has this always been the case, but the financial numbers involved presently are just bigger?
I think the issue is that football has become more of a gamble. And one way of securing a seat at a gambling table is to put a lot of money into it. So with respect to both Bale and Ozil, when they were signed, everybody thought it was a fantastic signing for the club. Remember, yeah. And when people feared that they might leave the club, the club went back to the player with the complete support of the fans and said, we're going to give you an extension of a contract with a big pay rise on top of it. When Ozil was playing superbly for Arsenal, he was a magnificent player. Gareth Bale is still a magnificent player for Wales.
Indeed,
and he scored. I remember watching the Champions League final when he scored those goals against Liverpool. Yeah, they were. He was on fire that night, and therefore you reward those good moments, and then due to loss of form, personal issues, whatever it happens, the player's form falls off a cliff, or he falls out with the manager, and then you are left with a huge expensive legacy. It's to a certain extent it's due to the Bosman ruling, because. Mm. If we didn't have the Bosman ruling, and I'm in favour of the Bosman ruling, but if you didn't have it, clubs wouldn't be so concerned about a player getting to the end of a contract and walking away for nothing. So what they're now doing is that they're upgrading those contracts again and again, which is fine, provided the player's form is maintained. Once that player's form begins to decline, you've then left him with this awkward situation of, We've broke the bank in order to secure him for another 2 years. He's only half the player he was, so therefore nobody else is interested in him at that wage level, and he's going to stick around. Manchester City were famous for it, and Chelsea. I only realised that players like, I can't remember the name now. Players like Joe was at Manchester City for about 3 or 4 years, and he was nobody knew he was there. He was just being loaned out, and nobody knew about it. You've got players like Danny Drinkwater at Chelsea, who, again, I didn't realise that he was still on their books.
Still their books,
But I am aware of his salary, and I fully understand why nobody else is willing to pay it. So you have that scenario.
On a similar note, Tom Yeomans has asked one of those questions that, again, I love, because it's something that we talk about all the time, a phrase we use all the time, and we've never actually defined what it means. As Tom says, I always hear the term transfer listed or available for transfer when people talk about certain players, but is there actually such a thing as an official transfer list where a club will list a player, or if it's just a number of players commonly known as available for transfer between club agents and officials?
Well, I'm lucky I was able to go to our good friend, Jonathan Booker, and he says, as far as he's aware, there isn't an official list of players available for transfer. However, the PFA does have a list of players who are out of contract, which clearly is slightly different, who are members of the PFA, and also a list of players who've been released from academies. But he says that he thinks they exist, but perhaps this was a question I could have asked Maheta last week when he was on the show. And also the transfer list, that is also a legacy term. A list of some clubs have of players that they want to sell, are prepared to sell, or want rid. They are not formally available, but here WhatsApp
is our friend. Because there are WhatsApp groups of sporting directors, managers, CEOs. So, you know, it's not official, but there are ways and means of finding out. And, you know, it involves just, you know, a few calls to the right people. So, you know, a good manager, a CEO or a sporting director will normally work proactively with the player's agent if the player is surplus to requirements as far as the club is concerned. You know, your face doesn't fit at some times. And, you know, I've had that at times in my career. I'm going, and you get called in and they're just encouraging you to start to look for a job elsewhere.
Mm.
And I think that's, and Jonathan says this is especially important with younger players, lower profile players and so on, to try to be sympathetic. And there are many, many good people in the football industry who might say, look, you know, we're a Premier League club or we're a Championship club. Realistically, you're not going to break in. You know, I know that we signed you because we thought that you were going to progress. Things haven't quite worked out. And they will then try to manage the exit to allow this young man to have a career in the industry. And there are plenty of those. There's a few managers, there's a few people in the game who are purely looking after themselves, but they are actually in the minority.
I'm sorry to hear your face didn't fit sometimes, Kieran. I have this very sad image of you being called into the back room of a Brighton sex shop and saying, oh, Kieran, I don't think the porn industry's for you. Try accountancy. When it comes to WhatsApp, I like the idea of every Monday afternoon a WhatsApp group of Premier League club CEOs going, did you hear price of football this morning? No. Eels? What was that about? And also, speaking of WhatsApp groups, there will be many, many people on WhatsApp groups, some of them called Away Travel, who will be interested in this question. And it comes from Matthew Rogers. Matthew says, I'm a Liverpool season ticket holder who finds it impossible to get tickets for away games due to the current loyalty program. Therefore, I have to watch our away games on TV. What I can't understand is why the Premier League is not planning to show all games on TV ongoing, especially after last season when they did this so successfully. Surely they are leaving money on the table in advertising and TV rights packages. I don't think the old argument of it affecting lower league attendances is credible anymore, considering the number of illegal streams available. It seems like prohibition to me, especially considering you can watch every game abroad. It's an interesting, because I think what a lot of football fans, or, you know, casual football fans don't realise is when they see, you know, they go, oh, there's a lot of Brighton fans at that game, or there's a lot of Palace fans at that game. They're the same fans for the most part. If you know, there were 3,000 Palace fans at Burnley yesterday, 2,900 of them go to every away game, so they get the points, which means they can keep going to the away games. So a club like Liverpool will have thousands, tens of thousands of fans who go to every home game, but can't get a ticket for the away games. And I think Matthew's got an interesting point. Why is he not able to watch every game without having to resort to an illegal stream?
It's because club owners have voted for that to a certain extent. I think there is a historic concern that away fans won't travel if every match is made available. There is still the 3 o'clock blackout terms of you can't show matches there. Would I have gone to Villa yesterday if I could have watched it free effectively for nothing? If I'd known what our performance was going to be like, if I had foresight, then yeah. But you know, and I'm not whinging here, but the cost of a train journey and car parking was 80 quid. It was 30 quid for a ticket. We went for a curry afterwards. We're in the pub beforehand. You know, I'm not getting change from £200 for a day out.
Yeah.
And you know, no whinges. You know, nobody's forcing me to do it. But if I could also have had a few mates round, order a pizza, watch it live on TV, that might have been fact. So I think there is an issue for some clubs in terms of will have an impact on away fans. It won't affect Liverpool. It won't affect Manchester United. They will always sell out their away allocation because, you know, they are clubs with huge fan bases. I think Matthew
is right to raise the issue of the cartel in terms of loyalty points or waypoints. You know, I know some fans of big clubs in the Premier League, and they will be a group of 12 of them, and they will have six tickets for away fans, and they always apply so to keep up your loyalty points. And they will allocate it. They'll go on a rotation basis, but it is the same old faces. And also because demand exceeds supply. If it is going to, no disrespect to Southampton or Brighton or some of the other clubs who we are not great places to visit to in terms of the reputation of the club, in terms of the history and the heritage of football and so on, then some of those clubs will end up in third party hands, and the issue of touting and tickets is something which isn't really addressed by the industry, because they're trying to get 30, 40, 50,000 people into a stadium in half an hour before a match kicks off, and the stewards, if they checked all the details of people turning up with a ticket, there would be huge queues. People would be kicking off. You know how leery it can get before a match, and people get waved through.
I often wonder if clubs, particularly in the Premier League, realise how much horse trading goes on in terms of loyalty points and away tickets on various WhatsApp groups. Because the WhatsApp group I'm part of, the Palace fans WhatsApp group, I love them all, but it's very rare that all of us, there's about 14 of us on the group, that all of us can get tickets for an away game. Finlay, if you're listening, there's one more question to go, and then Daddy will be on the beach with you, and your ears will be streaming in the wind.
I've sent you a photo of him, actually, looking very forlorn.
Oh, bless him. Well, he's got that sort of face. He always looks quite forlorn, doesn't
he? Yes.
He's not a smiley-looking dog. He's a lovely dog by the look of him. I've never met him. So, yeah. Our last question, Finlay, comes from Mitchell Heath. One day, Kieran will take you for a walk on Mitchell Heath, if you're lucky. How many times has Mitchell heard that in his life? Apologies, Mitchell. But Mitchell Heath is a long-suffering fan. He's a lifelong Coventry City fan. That's a brilliant away day. It used to be a lovely away day.
Yeah.
The Rocket in Coventry, fantastic. As a lifelong Coventry City fan, I wondered if there are any in-depth details around the new 10-year rental agreement for the Ricoh Arena, for example, rent, share of matchday revenue, ongoing court case stipulations, etc. Let's hope it's the last time we are made to play in a different city before Sisu actually decides whether they are building a new ground or not. And I think Coventry fans, they deserve a special mention, don't they, in dispatches, because they've really, it's not been easy supporting Coventry in the last few seasons, has it?
No, they've been put through it, and for people not familiar with Coventry, they were acquired by a hedge fund called Sisu, who, trying to work out their motives, was again challenging. I think it became fairly clear fairly quickly that it was property related. They were not the owners of the stadium, but they were trying to become the owners of the stadium at a relatively knocked down price. So in respect of Mitchell's specific question, there's no details as yet. I mean, they were paying around about £1.3 million a year at the Ricoh, which I believe is now called the Coventry Building Society Stadium, which doesn't exactly flow off the tongue. So that's their rental cost. In the most recent accounts, they paid £1.1 million to rent at Birmingham, it would appear. And that's a lot of money coming out of a smaller degree of matchday revenue. So, that was a tough year that they had. So that's all that we do know. I believe that there is a break clause in the 10-year agreement, and on the back of that... So there is a break clause. He's now opened the door. He's got up and sold.
He slammed it then, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Sorry, Kieran, carry on.
Sisu have spoken about a stadium at Warwick University, which isn't central Coventry. So, you know, as somebody that supports a club who have a ground which is next to a university, you know, that's not great. It's imperfect in terms of the logistics of transport. But some, you know, if it's better than the alternative, then you take it. They are committed to 10 years, but I believe that they would be able to walk away from the rental agreement if they commit themselves to a new stadium and they're in a position where they can move into it. But the actual fine print of the details, we won't really find out very much until the accounts are published.
Yeah, and anyone interested in the history of football should have a look at what happened to Coventry in the 60s when Jimmy Hill took over. Jimmy Hill, as older fans will know, was an ex-player, quite a radical ex-player. He was responsible for ending the minimum wage system back in 1961, I think, maximum wage rather, and did some remarkable things at Coventry in the 60s, including my favourite, which is laying on a disco train for away games, which, I mean, it was a brilliantly 60s thing to do, but you got on a special to go to the away game and there was a disco on board. But they were a really forward-thinking club back in the day, and now they end up, you know, you had that brilliant almost city centre stadium, Highfield Road, and they ended up with this. I mean, a friend of mine was a Coventry City home and away fan, went to his first game at the Rico and never went again because he just said, this is not Coventry, it's not Coventry City, but it's a club that's been hard done to, but a club that for its size was an amazing, almost, again, to use that word, radical club. And of course, there was a time in the Premier League when their annual relegation escape was a joy to behold.
unless it was
your club that rent down instead. Thank you to everyone who asked a question today, and thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. That's gone from whimpering to barking now. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com, and I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell, which I suspect may be a short one because he's got an antsy dog.
Yes, walking around. Thanks for all the support, gang. If you want to support us in a non-Patreon way, if you go to that subscribe button on the Apple Podcast, and if you give us a review, you could give us 5 stars, doesn't matter what you say. Apparently it's the stars that matter, but it helps us from a business point of view. You could even say you'd rather it was presented by Jim Davison and Greta Thunberg, and we don't care. We don't care. And personally, I would listen to that.
I would listen to that. She would eat Jim Davison alive. Odious little man. Don't start me on Jim Davison. Greta Thunberg, well done, girl. Keep going. It's brilliant. Thank you, everybody. Take care. We'll see you again on Thursday.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.